Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
You crank out the books about one every 3 or 4 months, and this one is, if anybody wanted to know where the bones are buried, you might be able to find it in this book. And you cover past to present, because we end up with, I think, Edward Snowden is at the end, and we're starting way back with what was going on with the McCarthy era. And okay, so what's your favorite part of this book that you've got? Who was the most intriguing for you to research?
Well, I think for me the most intriguing part of the story, Wendy, is how the Russians in the early years of the Cold War, sort of 1950s. How the Russians would try to manipulate the contactee movement, people who claimed to have met human-like aliens in desert locations like in California, New Mexico, Arizona. And they would have these meetings with these very human-looking aliens, allegedly, and there would be a discussion of how to sort of save the human race and save the planet and prevent us from destroying each other. And this was sort of one of the primary areas in ufology in the 1950s. This was long before alien abductees and abductions. And this, as I said, was the domain of the contactees. Now, what's interesting is that a lot of the contactees said that the aliens that they met had governments and sort of ways of life that mirrored communism, which today kind of sounds bizarre and almost amusing, you know, the idea that they would have these meetings and the aliens would tell them that, communism is a good thing. That's what actually a lot of the contactees, like George Adamski, for example, actually said. If you read Adamski's early writings and his lectures on his alleged UFO encounters out in the California desert, he actually, in nearly all of his lectures, went out of his way to say that, yes, the aliens are communist and it's not bad at all. And the FBI, as a result of this, and because Adamski, his first book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, sold 125,000 copies, the FBI got very concerned with the idea or the theory that the Russians were sort of directing Adamski to talk about communism, but to do so in like a UFO arena and to try and reel people in. Now, if Adamski was just someone who, lectured on a Sunday afternoon to 5 or 6 people, the FBI probably wouldn't have bothered or taken any notice of him. But the fact he had 125,000 copies sold, never mind his lectures, the FBI essentially viewed him as sort of what today you'd be called a person of interest. And so they actually believed or concluded that the KGB, Soviet intelligence, were actually directing the contactees to try and spread communism, but to do so under the umbrella, if you like, of UFOs and the contactees and the Space Brothers.
What I wanted to ask about, this is one of the guys from the 40s, late 40s and early 50s, the contactees. They each were very unique, and I think Ida Cannenberg is one of the female. I think she was the first one who became very known for her original contact encounters, and she's not related or affiliated with this, but because of the small circles at that point that these contactees were known in, she probably ran across a few of them. The other one that I thought was fascinating was Robert Short, and he talked about military involvement. He was actually trying to contact ETs, and they said they were getting connections through ham radio, which is unusual because the others didn't mention that, but he said they were going to bypass that and go through telepathy, but they were shut down because the government closed their operations, saying they didn't have proper legal grounds for extraterrestrial or alien contacts. And I thought, well, okay, ham radio and Russian interference, that might be coincidental or convenient. And when I saw that, I'm thinking, you know what? That's why I was looking at your book thinking, this makes a lot of sense. And especially when the government's stepping in saying, you don't have authorization. Okay, well, I don't know where that exists, but there. So there you go, one of the contactees.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it wasn't sort of just directed to Adamski. Another one, sort of like the second wave of contactees, one of those was a man named Orfeo Angelucci, who wrote a number of interesting books on his encounters, again, with sort of very human-like aliens. And Angelucci said that after he started lecturing and writing his books and became sort of a well-known figure in ufology, he said at one particular lecture of his, a group of four or five men at the end of the lecture approached him and said, you know, could they chat with him? And he noticed immediately that they'd got an accent that was clearly not American or English, and he described it as being European, but he wasn't entirely sure. And they took him out for dinner, but as the evening progressed, it became sort of sinister and almost bullying, and they insisted that he try and slant his lectures down again like a communist path. And Angelucci chose not to do that, and he started to get really weird phone calls and threats and sort of put people, you know, these voices on the phone pushing him to add like a party line, you know,
yeah,
to the whole slant of his lectures. And to his credit, he actually approached the FBI and said, look, you know, these people are contacting me and I'm kind of concerned, and they're trying to, you know, promote communism through my lectures. And the FBI opened a file on Angelucci. What's particularly interesting is that by the FBI's own admission, in 2009, they actually destroyed the file on Angelucci. So we actually don't know the full extent of what was in that file, but just the fact that they did destroy it is in itself, you know, intriguing.
I want to come back because there's another one that the Majestic 12 figures in here, the other one that Glickman, an artist named Glickman. I want to come back because there's another episode that has to do with what we did with a certain type of CS. I'm trying to remember the name of it now. The program that mind messing, the molding, whatever they did with several guys, and I can't remember the name. Darn the book.
I mean, actually, Angelucci was one of those.
Oh, what? Okay.
He talked about how he met this guy named Adam who looked human but who Angelucci suspected was an alien, very much like us. Kind of like the scenario, if you've seen the old movie The Day the Earth Stood Still with Michael Rennie, where you have this sort of very human-looking alien trying to put the world to rights, so to speak. But Angelucci said he had a meeting with this entity, if you like, however you want to term it, out in a diner in the California desert, and just a couple of hours outside of LA. And he said that at one point this man called himself Adam told Angelucci that before they could talk about what Adam knew, that Angelucci had to take a pill. Which he gave to Angelucci.
Okay, wait. Okay, stop. We're going to stop with the pill.
Okay.
We're going to come back with the pill. And the name I was, MK Ultra. Okay, so hang on a second. Nick is a prolific author of the latest Flying Saucers from the Kremlin. Nick Redfern, Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio. Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio. Flying Saucers from the Kremlin, Nick Redfern. UFOs, Russian meddling, Soviet spies, and Cold War secrets. And one of the projects that was going on was MK Ultra. We'll get into that. That's the name I couldn't remember. Okay, with this, though, we were about ready to take a pill.
That's right.
Okay.
We were. And fairly unwisely, Angelucci decided to take the pill. And in a very short time, he found his mind sort of altered and changed, and he had graphic hallucinations, and he'd clearly been dosed with something. We don't know what it was. But whatever this pill was, it had Angelucci sort of reeling off at full speed, basically telling this man, Adam, all that he knew about aliens and UFOs. And they got around again to the idea of discussing communism and was it good or was it bad. And whoever this Adam was, he clearly, again, was trying to sort of impress the communist side of all of this. So I would not be surprised if Adam had not actually been like a Soviet, either a Soviet spy that had sort of penetrated the US, or somebody in the US who was sympathetic to communism and who'd been recruited to try and find what they could from Angelucci. So it's a very weird and strange era when you've got the FBI chasing aliens that are communist and Space Brothers and contactees who were promoting the communist angle, whether they realized it or not.
And see, that's what's mind-boggling when you get into this and start to connect the dots. The other person that was influenced, Glickman, and he's the one who said a CIA agent had slipped him a Mickey.
Yeah, this is a guy named Stanley Glickman. And he had a very strange situation, again, in the 50s when he was living in France, in Paris. And he had a strange experience, almost 99.9% identical to that of Angelucci, where a pill was dropped into his drink and his mind started to get altered and changed. And, again, he started babbling and reeling off his thoughts on communism, and whatever this pill was that he took, it actually sort of damaged him for the rest of his life. He didn't really recover properly from the sort of graphic hallucinations that that sort of overwhelmed him.
Well, and see, he triggers it back. He believes that it was the CIA, and this is part of the MK Ultra stuff, because the guy that he described who had a limp that fit the bill as a description for somebody who was involved with that.
Yeah, his family actually tried to take legal action, and it didn't really, you know, work at all, because a lot of it was sort of circumstantial data rather than hard evidence. But there's no doubt that when you look back at a lot of these stories from the 1950s, there is this angle of sort of hallucinogenics and mind-altering technologies, and in some cases to learn from the people like the contactees, but in other cases to try and control their mind and dictate the nature of their lectures and conferences.
Well, and that's what's so frustrating, because it gets very convoluted with who's doing this, the Russians or you know, the Americans, CIA, because that's where that came back in with the MK Ultra project. That was absolutely incredible what they were allowed to do, and there's a death toll that went along with that.
Well, I think the important thing to note is that both sides at that time were developing sort of mind-altering technology like MK Ultra, things like that. But also at the same time, both sides, Russia and America, were realizing how the UFO subject could be manipulated. In other words, as I point out in the book, there's no doubt that there's a real UFO phenomenon. You know, I'm 100% convinced there's a real UFO phenomenon. But intelligence agencies have used the subject for sort of political reasons as well, and trying to alter and affect the mindset of the public. As I said, along the lines of you know, what Adamski was doing potentially on behalf of the Russians. So, you know, that's where it does get admittedly confusing, when you've got real UFOs and you've got fabricated stories of UFOs created by Russian spies to freak out the U.S. public.
Well, and it doesn't take much. Okay, yeah, that's the one thing. When there's a question of whether it's legit and whether it can, you know, you can be induced into having something that you think is an extraordinary experience, and you go back and realize that, no, you were just slipped a Mickey.
Mm-hmm.
That, it's frustrating. And not only that, when you can be spied on by satellites or anything, the technology that we don't have any, I guess, a mainstream realization about, that's frustrating because you can't track it. And, you know, where do you go from there?
Well, yeah, you're right. And I mean, that's why we have to be very careful, you know, when we look at a lot of these incidents and claims, because although there are, you know, genuine UFO encounters, I think some of them were staged, and the contactees particularly didn't realize that the sort of full scope of what was going on behind the scenes. So, but that's, you know, that's how sort of spies and counterintelligence people work, disinformation people, where they will create what seems like a really cool, fascinating story, but there's a reason for it. You know, it's not just the telling of the story. And I think that's an important thing to note, is that, you know, anybody in the UFO subject, if you're approached by mysterious characters who are willing to share, you know, data with you, the important thing to note is, well, why are they approaching you? You know, are you working on something that may be of concern to them, or they may want to spread the story further? So there's a lot of issues to think about when you start dealing with things like Russian spies and the KGB and how they, you know, were determined to find alternative and odd ways, like UFOs, to essentially play with the mind of the U.S. government.
To subvert, yeah. Okay, hang on just a second. Nick Redfern, my guest, Flying Saucers from the Kremlin. That's what we're talking about. We're going to switch gears and go into Bigfoot. Well, just because. Because he was part of the lecture series at UFO Hub recently. It's Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio. They have a language. It's really cool. Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio. Time flies when I'm talking with Nick. Okay. Just in case you're wondering about the UFO stuff that could be legit, one of those, John Foster, a Nebraska contactee, he saw it back in 1952, I believe, is when they had the sighting there of a saucer on the playground. And most of his sightings, he's had witnesses. He's only been alone for maybe three or four, but the other sightings and encounters he has had, and it drove him crazy. So just to bring that back into the equation, then the Ariel phenomenon, that movie is supposed to be coming out anytime, with the sighting that John Mack went over and interviewed the kids, and then they went back and reconnected with them as adults to find out just how much their mind had been blown. Could they deal with reality? This stuff is fascinating. So there's some other aspects of this that I believe have nothing to do with Russia or the United States. It's a third entity out there saying, okay, come on, guys. And their message seems to be more theme-based on planetary rescue. So if there's a theme from the other and the other side, it's not about Russia or the U.S. or who's in control, but saying, okay, guys, you have nowhere to go from here. Nick, you were at the UFO Hub lecture series in Eureka Springs recently, and there is, fortunately, a video of your presentation. But I wanted to ask you, because I just saw the article you wrote, and I've got it here because I printed it off, since otherwise I lose track if I don't. Mysterious Universe on Bigfoot. What did you saw John Nelson, and he's a linguist, and he's got tape, and he says they have a language. What was your impression in getting, you know, getting in contact with some of the Bigfoot people about that?
Oh, I thought that was a really good lecture, because I mean, it's one of the areas of Bigfoot research that a lot of people aren't aware of. I mean, if you're in the field, they are, but for people who may sort of just have a tangential interest or haven't really dug into it deeply, yeah, the idea that, you know, the Bigfoot creatures may have a language is a fascinating one. But then in saying that, you know, you can look at like gorillas, chimpanzees. I mean, they have different vocalizations for different issues. Mm-hmm. It's not obviously a language to the extent that we have one, but, you know, they have different calls and cries and things like that. And so, you know, with the lecture itself, I mean, it was fascinating because of some of these recordings that were presented at the lecture. You know, clearly there was no way that people could make some of these these vocalizations. Yeah. I mean, the speed of them and the sound and the way they were presented, you know, if you listen to them, there's just no way a person could mimic something along those lines. And this, of course, begs the question, if they have a language, well, are they just sort of an unknown ape, or could they be like a primitive type of human that sort of, you know, continue to survive over hundreds of thousands of years? So there's a lot of, you know, questions to be asked and intriguing implications when it comes to this issue of, does Bigfoot have a language?
Well, I thought it was a fascinating presentation, yeah. And I liked your presentation as well. And if you're eurekasprings.org, check the UFO lecture series, UFO Hub lecture series. You'll find out more about that. Scott Nelson and Nick Redfern and Sherry Wild was there too. The other thing, in getting back to the story, I didn't know how much you were going to cover. You got into Edward Snowden as well, and the fact that, you know, love him or hate him, he did everybody a favor by saying there's nothing secret.
Well, I mean, that's certainly the case today, you know. I mean, anything that somebody might want, you know, somebody to keep something hidden, there's not much chance of doing that today. You know, the way in which our privacy, I guess, is sort of being eroded is a perfect example of that. You know, I mean, most people today have got a smartphone, if not an iPhone, and you think about it, I mean, that phone contains all your data. You know, people do their banking on it, you know, planning to see the doctor about this or that. And if you think about it, you're in a situation where somebody hacks into that. They basically have your history and a great deal of data about you. So in that sense, you're right. There's not much really today that can be hidden, even stuff that, you know, that really should be private material, but it actually isn't anymore. And so it kind of begs the question, where's it all going to go? You know, and people sometimes say to me, do you think we're all going to end up implanted, you know, with tracking devices? Well, my answer is no, I don't think we will be, because we're basically already implanted. It's, you know,
yeah.
It's called an iPhone. Yeah, you know, you can go anywhere and be tracked. That's what it comes down to. And of course, a lot of people, you know, sort of slightly off topic, but a lot of people don't realize always that, you know, if you're using your iPhone and you're not hooked into like a secure provider, well, in theory, anyone can hack into it. You know, I actually have friends who, you know, actually doing their, you know, online work, and they're just picking up some random provider here or there, mm-hmm. instead of using a secure one. And a lot of people don't seem to understand that concept, you know, that you can just, yes, you can pick up a signal and get on the net, but you don't know who's listening because it's not secure.
Yeah, yeah, it could be used for any number of reasons, not just, you know, to get into your bank account, but maybe to put in a false identity. You know, we know all those problems are out there. But coming back to your information about a lot of clandestine things that were happening and are happening, it means that even if you're studying things, like I think you said your next book you're working on is assassinations, there you have to be careful about where you're getting your information. You have to look, is there an agenda with this information? Because at this point, it's pretty easy to go in and, you know, do your own wiki page until they track you down. They're having a tough time doing that now. So where do you get information with this kind of proliferation of subterfuge and people messing with the facts in some way, shape, or form?
Well, that's a good point, because when you're dealing with something like UFOs, which is controversial enough to start with, you know, you do have to sort of be aware of, you know, well, I need to make sure this person's being legitimate, and is there backup testimony and documentation for this or that? So what I always try and do is try and take a journalistic approach to investigating what is a very strange subject. And I sort of never jump in and say, oh, I've been given this amazing story and just spread it across the internet, I'm very, very careful about, you know, how I validate the story, or I don't validate it, you know. But I think the worst thing we can do as people in the UFO field is to just dump it all out there before it's fully investigated, because then, you know, it's like the cat's out the bag, so to speak. So I think, for me at least, it's very important to get corroborative sources and information, and carefully and slowly put together the story that you're putting together. And you know, on occasion I've seen people who just don't do that. You know, they see a sensational story and they're like, okay, let's just put it out, this is cool. And that can actually cause damage by doing that, because for the simple reason that, you know, it could backfire and turn out to be a hoax or something that's...
like Storm Area 51, maybe? Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah,
Hold on.
Yeah.
I want your thoughts on that.
I have my own thoughts
In the next break, okay, hold on a second here. And Nick Redfern, Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio. Wendy's Coffee House, KCMO Talk Radio. Nick Redfern, my guest, flying saucers from the Kremlin, and a whole lot more. We're just all across the board here, Bigfoot, aliens. The fun thing about Storm Area 51 is nobody had a clue how incredibly, enormously, ginormously popular that was going to be until it was, like 2 million people. I signed up, I interested, not going interested, because I wanted to follow the storyline. Okay, Nick, you had some thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, this whole issue of sort of storming Area 51, which is getting sort of closer and closer, a lot of people sort of viewed this as, you know, an exciting thing, kind of like a ufological version of Lollapalooza, where, you know, thousands of people are going to turn up and it's all going to be cool. And, you know, the important word is, you know, storm or storming, uh-huh. You know, which implicates the idea of charging on the base, you know. And certainly that's how, you know, security people have actually said if there's any attempt to penetrate the base, you know, they will respond in kind, so to speak. Now, a lot of people think this is going to be fun and cool, etc. But the fact is, take the name Area 51 out of the equation, you know, take UFOs out of the equation, and what you've got are people who think it's cool and who actually might try and find a way to penetrate the base. Now, that's no different to saying, I'm going to try and penetrate and break into the Pentagon. And what would happen if you did that? Well,
yeah.
At the very least, you're going to be arrested. In today's world, you might end up with lead in your head, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so my view is that no one at all should be thinking it's cool to try and break into a U.S. military base, because it's only going to end badly. And you cannot blame, you know, the military if they have to take action, because multiple people are, you know, 500 feet away from the perimeter and there's thousands of them charging. I mean, you know, the government has to protect its facilities, because who's to say that some of the people mingling among the real UFO people,
right.
I mean, they could be terrorists or anybody.
Yeah.
You know, nobody has any idea who those people might be descending on the base. So I don't think there's anything clever or right about breaking into a U.S. military base.
Well,
I mean...
They've got to rearrange. I think at this point they're saying it's going to be, you know, alien fest or alien stock.
Well, if it's like an alien festival kind of thing and it's done sort of 10, 20 miles from the perimeter and everybody just sitting around drinking a few beers and chatting about UFOs, well, there's nothing wrong with that. But to me, a deliberate attempt to try and penetrate the base, which is, you know, what some people have talked about, to me, that's where the line is crossed, and it shouldn't be crossed, you know.
Well, I will say, if you are interested in any of this, the Little Alien Inn is booked up, and they do suggest that you find another if you're going, find another source for gasoline. And remember, there are one more thing, no bathrooms, and desert, okay? So dress accordingly.
Yeah, it's not going to be nice and cool out there.
No. This is a whole different environment. Hostile, you might say. Of all of the stuff that you have written, and I liked The Men in Black because you had a paranormal experience or several with that. What was your favorite topic?
Well, actually, my favorite topic to write about is the Men in Black mystery. I've done 6 books on the subject now and working on another because I get so many accounts from people. Now, when people, you know, think of the Men in Black, they think of Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah.
With the movies.
The good
Men
in Black.
If you speak to the witnesses who've been sort of threatened and terrified and intimidated by the real Men in Black, they describe them as very different. They don't even sound like or look like they're human. They're very pale and skinny. They have these bulging eyes that they hide behind, these wraparound sunglasses, and they seem to have the ability to sort of control people's minds. And they're almost, the way you can look at them, they're almost like a biological robot, you know, sort of like a constructed creature that sort of vaguely looks human, but if you got a little bit too close, you'd think, wow, what's wrong with that person, you know? And
yeah.
People say that their skin looks like plastic, and they don't seem to fully understand our mannerisms and even the way we speak. So it's almost as if, you know, you're dealing with like an alien human hybrid or something generated or created to sort of maneuver among us in a camouflage fashion almost.
What's the purpose? I mean, of all of the majority of the contacts, what's the purpose?
Well, actually, like the movies, which were based on real cases, primarily the people who encounter the Men in Black are threatened not to talk about their UFO experiences. So, you know, the Hollywood got that part right. The part they got wrong was that the real Men in Black don't work for the government. They have sort of far more of a paranormal aspect to them than they do sort of a secret agent aspect.
Okay, yeah, so we don't really know who they answer to.
Or what they are.
Yeah, that too. Okay, well, and with your experience, you know, don't reading this book puts you in, there's a warning. Be careful. They might connect with you. Have you had any contacts?
I've had a few weird things that have happened that people who've had encounters with the Men in Black have also reported. Like, for example, weird phone calls in the middle of the night and strange voices and bizarre kind of static and noises on the phone. And John Keel, way back in the 1960s, when he was researching the Mothman stories in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, he got that kind of thing happened to him, and he viewed it as an attempt of intimidation. Mm-hmm. You know, the phone ringing at 3 a.m., and of course, most people think that's bad news.
And, yeah, it is, usually.
Well, it is usually, yeah. And so people panic, you know, and race to the phone, and then there's this sudden strange metallic voice on the phone warning people not to talk about UFOs. I've actually had several weird, strange things like that happen, but, you know, I'm not sort of easily intimidated. I have more of a, well, bring it on kind of.
Okay, let's see what happens next.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Is this the second or third warning? Does it matter? Yeah, it's one of those like 3 strikes, you're out. Well, this is only strike 2.5.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's sort of a lot of issues like this to think about, you know, when you're dealing with MIB cases. And I know of people who become totally paranoid after being threatened by the Men in Black. And, I mean, literally kind of like peering through the curtains at night, hoping they're not there, mm-hmm. you know. And a lot of people have found their lives sort of really, you know, plunged into a sort of a state of fear, I said paranoia, and a worry that one day they're going to come back. And for some people, it sort of dictated their lives and changed them, you know, for the worse.
Like the pill that Glickman got.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it just you know, really plays with your mind. And but just one thing to note, I mean, you made a very good point when you talked about, you know, the fact that there are real UFO encounters. You know, it's not all, you know, fabricated and manipulated. That's one of the things I point out very early in the pages of the book, that there is a real UFO phenomenon, but it's unfortunate that counterintelligence people, spies, secret agents, etc., they've used a very real phenomenon as a means to sort of control, manipulate, and alter belief systems.
Part of it is they know you're paying attention. Like, one of the top searches is UFO, so it's a guaranteed slam dunk that someone's going to pay attention to it. Hey, Nick, thank you. I love what you're doing. I love talking with you. I'm glad that you are so incredibly prolific with your content. Anybody listening, Nick Redford, Fortean, Blogspot. Okay, check it out. In the meantime, the book we were talking about was Flying Saucers from the Kremlin. But there's something for everyone in this laundry list of books of all sorts of unexplained and incredibly interesting topics. All right, Nick, thank you.
All right, thanks, Wendy.
All right, and if you're listening, I'll put some links on the Blogspot site, Wendy's Coffee House. There's just too many things to choose and focus on, so I choose not to focus. How's that? It's fun. Stay curious. See ya.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.